You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. Today is our bi-weekly health update, where Dr. Mark Levine will join us to answer your questions. There's a lot to discuss when it comes to children ages 5 to 11 being able to get vaccinated, and there are still questions about booster shots, and even more questions about why Vermont COVID numbers continue to rise, even though we're one of the most vaccinated states in the country. But first, a longstanding dispute regarding public utilities in St. Albans is a topic of conversation for many residents. To help explain what's going on, I welcome Sean Robinson. He's a reporter with VT Digger and a Report for America Corps member with a special focus on issues of importance to Franklin and Grand Isle counties. Now, Sean, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks so much for having me, Connor.
Absolutely. So this all started in 2015, and as I understand it, the city of St. Albans decided to charge an additional fee to residents and businesses outside of the city that are in the town that use the city utilities. Now, if I got that right, what's the history behind this decision?
Yeah, sure. So I guess I'll start by just talking about the geography really quickly. So St. Albans City is surrounded entirely by the town. So that means that the residents of both those communities share a lot of things and they share a lot of resources. One of the things that they share is the public water and sewer system, but that's owned by the city. So anyone in the town who is part of that system, since 2015, they pay this additional fee on top of the regular water and sewer rates that somebody in the city might pay. And that fee is sort of what's at the heart of this issue.
Why did the fee get started? I mean, it kind of would just make sense that you would just pay the regular amount of, you know, for the water and sewer and then be done with it. So where did this extra fee come into place?
Yeah, so when I spoke with the city manager of St. Albans City, he told me that they see this as a way to protect the city's economic interests. So he said to me that normally when a municipality has utility customers like this, they, you know, can pay for that with tax revenue. But this is a utility that has customers who are outside of the city's tax base. So they feel that this is a way to kind of cover some of the cost of that from residents who technically live somewhere else.
You know, so you gave us a little bit of the geography of St. Albans. What's the relationship between the two communities?
Yeah, so like I mentioned, they do share a lot of things. So for example, they're both part of a unified school district with the nearby town of Fairfield. You know, town residents shop and dine in the city's downtown. There's a lot of stuff there. But they're also, you know, the governments do have some disputes over some services. So for example, this year, the city and the town were using the same police department run by the city, but the town opted to go with patrols from the Franklin County Sheriff's Department over the summer. That's just one example. But so the governments have had some disagreements over issues over the years, and one of those big ones has been water and sewer service. Actually, from 2011 to 2015, the city had a moratorium on any new water and sewer hookups in the town as part of these negotiations.
So I'm curious, you have the town paying the city this fee for water and sewer. Where is that money going? Like, how is the city using the money from that extra money from the town?
Yeah, so the city uses this for their general fund, what they call it. And that's really a fund that pays for lots of different city services. So like city fire department, the city police department. So they sort of use it like they might use tax revenue from anyone else who lives in the city.
And, you know, I think I'm just really curious to understand from your reporting, how are people responding to this bill and why is this coming up now if it's been part of the bill since 2015?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. So, and this was sort of what tipped me off to this last month was there's a group of homeowners who live in a senior housing community in St. Albans Town. And these homeowners got this affiliation fee bill last month for the first time ever. They didn't really have any idea what this bill was, what it meant. And some of them actually wrote to the city about it, kind of asking a question you might understand why they'd ask, right? Like, I'm getting charged, for instance, this one couple was charged $760, you know, on top of my regular water and sewer rates. What's up with that, right? So that's sort of how this came up last month. Yeah.
So, I mean, are they paying it? Like, what are they able to do? I mean, $700 and, you know, plus dollars, that's a lot of money that we're talking about. So are they paying it? Like, how is the situation being mitigated?
Yeah, so from what these residents told me right now, they're paying the fee, and this one couple I spoke with mentioned that they're going to pay it under protest, basically. But this is, again, you know, this is sort of their part of this really long-standing dispute between the two communities over this. And in total, there's about 30 residential and commercial users paying the fee right now, and it brings in about $100,000 for the city. But actually, 15 more users have been approved for an allocation and are going to come on to the system next year. So the program is only growing. And I guess we'll sort of see where it goes from there.
So 30 residents and businesses are paying roughly $100,000 to the city of St. Albans, like you just said. I'm curious, who are some of the big players involved in this, you know, when it comes to businesses? Because that's a lot of money to be split up, you know, 30 ways.
Yeah, definitely. So some of the big players are some of the companies that are located in the St. Albans Town Industrial Park. One of the big names is Ben & Jerry's, actually. Last year, they paid about $42,000 to the city for their affiliation fee, and that was from data that was provided to us.
And is the town of St. Albans able to step in and say, you know what, St. Albans City, we don't want to do this anymore? Like, how can they avoid this extra fee?
I think that's one of the questions about this too that I don't think has an answer yet. The communities have gone to court over this. When the fee was enacted in 2015, like you mentioned, the town sued the city over it the same month. It was in November. And they, in this lawsuit, and I also have a statement in the story from the select board chair in St. Albans Town saying that they feel like this fee is establishing extraterritorial land use controls in their community. They feel that it's a way for the city to capture extraterritorial property tax revenue in the town. So town officials are definitely opposed to this, and it's not something that they feel like is fair.
Now, you heard from those residents, but I'm wondering, how are businesses, and do you know, like, how businesses like Ben & Jerry's and some of the bigger corporations that I would presume get stuck with a bigger portion of this extra fee, how are they responding to all of this?
Yeah, so my story, I just focused on speaking with these residents. So I didn't speak with any of the businesses per se. So I don't know if I could quite answer that. So I guess I'm not sure, but at least from the residential side, it's definitely something that some people are upset about.
Now, before I let you go, I just want to ask, as I do everybody, is there anything else that you want people at home to know about your reporting on this story in St. Albans?
Let's see. I think I'm not sure. I mean, one thing I was going to mention, like I did before, was just that there's been some other kind of disputes between these two communities this year. The policing thing I mentioned before was one of them. One other issue that's come up is, back in March, town voters effectively voted to pull out of an agreement between the city and the town over a new municipal pool. And this is kind of an example of just how it works. So the pool is on a property that's owned by the city, but the property is located in the town. So there's just a lot of crossover, and it's a really kind of interesting setup, I guess. And there's a lot of stories and a lot to look at in terms of how those two communities play with each other.
Well, we certainly look forward to reading more of your reports. That's Sean Robinson. He's a reporter with VT Digger and a Report for America Corps member with a special focus on issues of importance with Franklin and Grand Isle counties. Sean, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Connor.
An FDA advisory committee is recommending emergency use authorization of the Pfizer COVID vaccine in children ages 5 to 11. Meanwhile, the agency itself has approved a mix-and-match approach to COVID booster shots. This is all happening while Vermont is one of the states with the highest vaccination rates, but has the 17th highest COVID rates in the country. Not only that, but Orleans County had the highest COVID rates east of the Mississippi River earlier this week. To help us explain what all the numbers mean and hopefully add a glimmer of hope, we welcome Vermont Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine to the show. Dr. Levine, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
So I just want to start out, before we get to the stuff, I just saw an email that said that it was from the health department that said Vermont confirms its first human case of the West Nile virus illness. So I just want to know, like, what do we know about that right now?
Okay, so West Nile virus is something we track every season. As you know, somewhere around the turn of this decade, it became evident that it was in our country and could infect humans. But having said that, it's very rare that we see a major case or complication of it. It's mosquito-borne, which means that you get it from a mosquito bite. And until we get our first frost, mosquitoes will still be active, though certainly not as active as they are when it's a little bit warmer. And somewhere around 20% of people who are going to come down with any symptoms from West Nile virus will have kind of a flu-like illness, just general achiness, fatigue, some fever. Very few, certainly under 1%, will develop anything more severe. And the more severe part of West Nile virus is an encephalitis, which means essentially inflammation in the brain. So a neurologic complication of the virus. So we did have one case reported. And since 2003, just to put this in perspective, there have been 14 confirmed human cases of West Nile virus in Vermont. So this is still a very, very rare event. And it came in a season when actually the mosquitoes that we sample, because we do that every year, didn't show any evidence for West Nile virus. Of course, that's a sampling issue, but still over 1,600 mosquito pools were tested and we didn't find either West Nile virus or a more severe encephalitis called triple E, Eastern equine encephalitis.
And for people at home, as I'm reading this press release, it says that it was somebody that is a Chittenden County resident. So does that mean, like, how concerned should Vermonters in Chittenden County and all over the state be with this diagnosis?
Yeah, well, I mean, we should all be concerned, but we shouldn't have this markedly change our life. First of all, a Chittenden County resident, but it doesn't mean the mosquito bite was in Chittenden County. It could have been, or it could have been hiking in another part of the state, or it could have been visiting another state. We don't really know that for a fact. And it is a very, very rare event and an unusual thing to happen. So we need to put that in perspective. But the bottom line is, not that we are all looking forward to the first frost, and some parts of the state have had frost, but in terms of a true frost for across the state of Vermont, that will mark the end of any need for concern because you won't be seeing mosquitoes around from that point on.
Let's go to the phones where we have John from Stratford. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Dr. Levine, thank you for your hard work and service over the last year and a half in particular. I'm over 70. I was looking to get a flu shot and a COVID-19 booster and found out that my pharmacy is beginning to get full of people and just wondering, is it okay to take them both at the same time?
It is definitely okay to take them both at the same time. And not that we're recommending it, but it's certainly something that we find no problem with. And the CDC has come out and said directly that's a great strategy, mainly because of the concern you just showed with getting in a timely way to get separate injections, but also because people tend to naturally put off things. And you may go in and get one and say, oh, I'll remember to get the other, and then the time never comes. So it is a good strategy to use and get them both out of the way. And I certainly recommend it for those who wish to pursue that.
Now, Dr. Levine, I'm curious, like, we continue to talk about how Vermont has one of the highest vaccination rates in the country, but we continue to see these case numbers go up. I'm wondering, where is the disconnect in vaccines and case numbers here in Vermont?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked me that. So our vaccination rates, by the way, continue to go up too, which is a good thing. And the most important thing with the Delta variant is the fully vaccinated rate, because we know from good literature that one dose of an mRNA vaccine for the Delta variant isn't really adequate. Your immunity is not at the level you need it to be until you get both doses. So we want that to happen for people who need to be vaccinated for the first time, for sure. With regard to boosters, Vermont was so successful in effectively and efficiently getting our population vaccinated very early in the game. So there may be some members who got the very earliest vaccines that actually have some waning of their immunity. So the boosters have actually arrived at just the right time for that. Now, to put the cases into perspective, obviously we watch these cases very, very closely. And we look nationally, regionally, and locally. And what we found is that New England as a region, the Northeast, which is the most well-vaccinated portion of the entire country, has not had anywhere near the same peak of cases that less vaccinated portions of the country have shown all along. They've not had the same steep incline in cases going up and then more rapid steep decline coming down. And what that represents in those populations is a very unvaccinated population who are very quickly being found by the Delta virus, and people are then getting their immunity in that more, as it's called, natural way, because the lesser of a proportion of the population had the vaccine. What we're finding in the Northeast is all of the states have had a very gradual, milder incline in a much more sustained level of a plateau that's taking a little longer to go away. And that's actually showing our primary mitigation strategy in the Northeast, which has been vaccination, and showing the success of it, even though we are all similarly distressed by the height of the number of cases going, they still really pale in comparison to other parts of the country. And it's much more of a delayed and dampened curve than the other curves that we've seen. And that's just something we're having to live with. It's taking a little longer than the 9 or 10 weeks that many populations have experienced with Delta. But at the same time, we're seeing some real promising signs in this week's data, in the last several days, definitely, for sure. And our hope is that that trend will continue, but certainly don't want to overstate that until we see it's a true trend.
I'm curious, with children soon to be able to get their vaccines, at what point do you think we will treat this COVID-19 pandemic as the flu, and people that get it will just stay home, and we won't have such heightened awareness about it?
Well, part one of the answer is it does depend a bit on the uptake of the vaccine by the remainder of the population and by the parents of the 5 to 11-year-old age group. We certainly expect at minimum a third to 40% of people are going to want to have this vaccine very quickly and have already reviewed the science, understood the science, heard the guidance coming from national and local public health officials, and are ready to have their children get vaccinated. And then there's, like with anything new, going to be a portion of the population that's going to take some more time before they come to that decision definitively. So it all depends on how much in that early wave happens, because the higher the percentage of that age group that gets vaccinated, the lower the risk to that age group as well as to the rest of the society in terms of protecting all of us together. But the other part of the answer is that I think when we talk about what you're talking about, which is endemic, meaning we're no longer in a pandemic, but we're now sort of where the virus is sort of part of our background. It's going to be there every season. It's going to be like the flu, where we'll see cases, but we won't see the same amount because we have very, very effective vaccines that much of the population has accepted. So that's probably a 3 to 6 month period, I would say. So we'd like to see that happen overnight. Probably won't happen till the first third to a little longer in 2022.
Not the news I wanted to hear, but at least there's a little glimmer of hope that, you know, we're nearing the end of this pandemic. Now, one of the questions I got on Twitter for you was people wanting to know why you did not wear a mask when you were promoting the flu shots. I guess there's a picture of you doing it, and people are upset by that, and they just want to know why.
Was it when I was getting my flu shot?
I believe so. They said the exact question was, question for Dr. Levine, why no mask when promoting flu shots? Lead by example.
Yeah, well, I certainly wear my mask to lead by example in abundant places. But we were in a room with vaccinated people spaced out in there for a very short period of time to just sit down, get your shot, and then we were done. Whole thing was done within 5 minutes. And we were all vaccinated and distanced appropriately. So that was an opportunity for us to use good judgment, I would say, and make our case for the flu shot in an effective manner. I certainly, you know, don't feel that we should have to have the mask as a symbol all the time in every particular thing we do in life. We've tried to message to the population that you don't want to be in a crowded indoor setting for a prolonged period of time without a mask. But certainly something that is, I'll call it transactional like that, was not one of those times that a mask was going to be essential for us to wear. I certainly wear it every time I go into retail establishments. I wear it whenever I have to talk in front of a group of people in a smaller space. If I have to go to a restaurant where I'm usually getting takeout, I wear it on the way in, etc. So I'm certainly not trying to give people the impression I've thrown the mask away by any means.
Let's go to Anne in Bradford. Anne, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. Dr. Levine, I'm jumping back to West Nile. I'm kind of new to the state, and every year I get bit multiple times with insects, including tons of mosquitoes. And since I've been here, my mental health has declined. I'm more spacey, and I also have a lot of joint pain I didn't have before. Is that a symptom, and is there a test to see if you have it?
So, number one, people who get ill from West Nile, it's much more of an acute illness. So the joint pain, achiness, what have you, you know, would last like it would last when you have an episode of the flu. It wouldn't be a prolonged thing. If you got a neurologic complication of West Nile, it would probably turn up rather abruptly and acutely. And not only would you not feel your thoughts were as clear or what have you, you would probably be evolving to lesser and lesser states of alertness to eventual coma. And then if you had residual symptoms, you might have residual symptoms like what you just described, but you probably would have been through a more serious illness beforehand. There is some blood work that can be done. It's often done on the spinal fluid, which I don't think you would need to have that part done. But yeah, I would recommend at this point, assuming that like most Vermonters, now that you're a Vermonter, you have a primary care physician or healthcare provider, that you connect with them about your concerns, because I can think off the top of my head of many, many things that I would think are more likely than West Nile virus that appropriate history and physical exam and some targeted testing could help you with. So bring those concerns to your clinician.
John from Shelburne writes in, and he wants to know, will there be school-based clinics for the vaccine of children ages 5 to 11 once the age group becomes eligible for vaccination next week? This has been discussed by the governor previously, but he has not heard any further details, plans, etc. So what do we know about school-based clinics once that age group becomes eligible?
The answer is absolutely 100%. And once we know the date that this will actually become authorized for our use, you'll start to hear at the press conferences and start seeing on the websites all the publications of what schools, what days, et cetera. This will definitely be a major part of our effort, which will complement what pediatricians and family practitioners will be doing in their own offices and what the pharmacies are able to do as well.
What can you tell us about details when it comes to these school-based clinics? Is it going to be students are sent home with a waiver and the parents sign it, or parents bring them in? What can you tell us?
Yeah, so I think it'll work very similarly to what we did with the 12 to 18-year-old groups, where the only difference being there may be more of a concern on parents' part that they want to be present with their child or what have you. So they may be actually not signing a waiver and sending somebody in, but actually be there at that time. It all depends on the parent and child and what their desires are for making that happen. But yes, there is clearly an informed consent process and a signature for a minor that it's okay for that minor to get vaccinated. That has to be part of the deal.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Steve in South Burlington. Steve, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First, I want to thank Dr. Levine for all his hard work and his team's hard work, and you guys have been great and real great resource for Vermont. My question is, when I hear new statistics on how many new COVID cases there are, I would like to hear how many of those new cases are people who haven't been vaccinated and how many are people that have already been vaccinated. I would like to know that, and I think it might be good for the public to know, and it might help light a fire under people who haven't been vaccinated yet. I'll hang up
yeah.
and do your answer.
Yeah, no, thank you for that. And we, you know, on a daily basis, we have it at that level. And I have to say that very consistently in the recent week or so, the numbers have come out in a way that 80 to 82% of the newest cases are unvaccinated. And that leaves, of course, 18 to 20% that have been fully vaccinated. We label them as fully vaccinated or unvaccinated or only within 14 days of their vaccine, so they're not fully effectively vaccinated yet. So that number has been steadily going up, you know, 82% range at this point in time. So when Commissioner Pichak presents his information at the press conferences, he generally shows a graph, which it does give people an idea regarding the new case rate per 100,000 and how it's impacted the fully vaccinated population and the not fully vaccinated population. And generally, it's been about a fourfold greater difference. If you are not fully vaccinated, you have a fourfold greater rate of having a new case per 100,000 than if you're in the fully vaccinated group.
Now, Dr. Levine, I'm curious, can you talk a little bit more about the new guidelines for contact tracing in schools and the rationale behind the change?
Sure. The biggest part of the rationale behind the change is to be consistent with CDC, be consistent with good science, continue to be safe, but try to make the process more user-friendly and efficient for those on the other end who are actually engaging in that. And some of the changes that were made, one of them had to do with making sure that we recognize that if students are in recess, they're generally outdoors, and being outdoors, very low risk of transmission during that time period, and probably not spending a lot of time worrying about that population of students because they clearly were at low risk anyways, and it burdens those who have to do the contact tracing if they're trying to possibly look in every nook and cranny, even places where the probability is very, very low, sometimes approaching zero, if you will. So that was one kind of consideration that was taking into effect. Otherwise, we revised the close contact definition to within 3 feet, again, for the usual 15 minutes over a 24-hour period. And we felt that schools should use that definition when it's reasonably possible to identify close contacts using that method. And that seems to work well on a national basis, and we thought it could work well here. Okay. We also recognized the issue of school buses and the fact that school buses, just being on a bus with an infected person is not the same as sitting next to the infected person while on the bus. So if buses are operating as advised with increased ventilation through windows opening and things of that sort, then if schools had enforced assigned seating, it would be easy to really focus on those people on the bus who were at highest risk and not every person on the bus.
Let's go to Megan in Norwich. Megan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Dr. Levine, for all your hard work. I just had a quick question. If I was wondering if you guys had taken into any consideration prioritizing kids 5 to 11 for an earlier shot, those with respiratory issues and or underlying conditions.
You know, I think at a time when vaccine is scarce, that would be an important strategy. We feel that based on what the Biden administration has promised and the amount of vaccine that should be coming into the state when this is authorized, which could be in a week right now from today or tomorrow, that we will have enough vaccine so that we probably don't need to have a strategy that sort of prioritizes people or confuses people and doesn't allow them to get vaccine as quickly as possible. So it's a great idea, and I certainly want those people to, parents know who their children are, and if they have a respiratory risk, make sure that they try to work on that themselves, either with the school-based clinic or with their own pediatrician's office. But we think there'll be enough vaccine so that in a relatively short time interval, the kids who want to get vaccinated very quickly will be able to.
Let's go to Patty in Pomfret. Patty, what's your question for Dr. Levine?
Hi, thank you. Dr. Levine, for folks who got the initial Johnson & Johnson vaccine, does the data support which booster may be most efficacious and most protective?
So the answer is, if you got the Johnson & Johnson first, just so everyone on the call knows here, that on the show, you have an option to get a booster after only 2 months. And that's different than the messenger RNA vaccines, which is a 6 month time interval. So if you got your primary series 2 months or longer ago, you're eligible for a booster. With regard to which booster you get, there is some preliminary data from a study done at the NIH that looked at the effect of the so-called mix and match or heterologous booster option using one of the three available vaccines. So all of the vaccines that were given as a booster to the Johnson & Johnson population did cause antibody levels to go up when tested after the fact. The Johnson & Johnson had the lowest rate in terms of the number of multiples of antibody load that were produced, but still a satisfactory response. The Moderna had the highest rate of causing more exuberant antibody response on the part of the person, and the Pfizer was in between. So the hierarchy was Moderna turned out to be the best, then Pfizer, then Johnson & Johnson. But having said that, they all produced what you would want, which is a boosted antibody response.
Let's go to Jim in Calais. Jim, welcome to the show with Dr. Levine.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is, you said 18 to 20% approximately of people who were fully vaccinated ended up testing positive for COVID. Of that 18 to 20%, what percentage had to be hospitalized?
I can't give you that information. I can tell you that of the people who are hospitalized right now, 60 to 70% are unvaccinated, hospitalized for COVID. 60 to 70% are unvaccinated. The remainder are vaccinated. So some are indeed getting into the hospital who were vaccinated. However, I wouldn't want anyone to take that and say, oh, that's a lot of people, because remember, the denominator of people who've been vaccinated is hundreds of thousands of people in Vermont, and the number of people who are unvaccinated is well less than 100,000, and currently is less than 60,000. So that's in the adults who were eligible to be vaccinated. So you have to look at the data in that important way. We still know, and the number will be, I suspect, revised with more analysis on this Friday's weekly summary that we publish on our health department website. But we still know that your chance of becoming a case at this point in time in the Delta surge, if you've been vaccinated already, fully vaccinated, your chance of becoming a case is 8 in 1,000.
Now, Dr. Levine, I'm curious. This is something that the governor gets hammered on at every single press conference, and so I want to ask you just head on. Lawmakers and healthcare professionals have been pushing for the governor to declare another state of emergency to address the high case rates that we have right now in the state. That way he could impose actions like an indoor mask mandate. Why is this not a good idea at this time?
Well, let's not look at it as why is it not a good idea, but talk about how one strategizes in this circumstance. I think a lot of people are forgetting that vaccination is a mitigation strategy. And yes, it has in the Northeast become a primary mitigation strategy because of the fact, as I said earlier, Nicole, that it's caused us to flatten the curve in a very natural way and not have healthcare systems be overwhelmed, as we were hearing about the Southwest, the South. Now states like Idaho and Montana and the North, all these states not only have had major surges in cases, very poor vaccination rates, but they have had their healthcare system become overwhelmed and, of course, had to make very hard decisions about patient care because of that. The Northeast has not seen that because we did not get up to that point on the curve where that would happen. So though we're watching that closely and never want that to happen, I believe vaccination is the primary reason why that hasn't happened. Now, having said that, it does not mean that we don't have any public health guidance going on for other mitigation strategies. You've heard us talk frequently about gathering sizes. In fact, just recently, with Halloween coming up, about gatherings and the impact they can have on cases expanding. You've heard us talk about wearing a mask indoors, no matter what your vaccination status. And you've heard the usual stuff about, of course, stay home if you're sick and don't expose yourself to other people. There are a very limited number of states right now that have states of emergency, if any. And even mask mandates, there's a half a dozen states plus the District of Columbia that have had a mask mandate in play. And I've been watching those very closely. And the reality is it's a very mixed experience. And I am a person who firmly believes all of the public health science about masks. I believe mask mandates have been shown to work through a lot of research that's gone on through the pandemic. I'm a little less convinced because of what I'm seeing unfold around the country and even in states with mask mandates that in the Delta surge, when we look back over this part of the pandemic, that we'll find that mask mandates actually were very helpful. We also do have mask mandates in a bunch of settings in school right now, with the exception in society right now, with the exception of one school in the state, the entire state school population is under mask mandates. When we look at long-term care facilities and healthcare facilities, they are under mask mandates. And we still have cases in those settings. So there are going to be cases no matter how strict we get. And we have a public right now that is out trying to live their lives, make good judgments about what they do and about what their risk is when they do what they do. But their appetite for being in a more restrictive environment, I would say, is very, very low at this point in time. And we would have to have a much stronger case in terms of needing to protect the capacity of our healthcare system or other pressures to be able to say that we could, as Governor Scott has said, exercise his emergency powers in that way when we're experiencing the current aspects of the Delta variant as it's playing out.
So is there any concern that you have? Because earlier this week, it was reported that Orleans County had the highest COVID rates east of the Mississippi. So it's not like this is an everybody else problem or this is a South problem. I mean, we have this problem right here that people are really concerned about and I think genuinely concerned about.
Oh, absolutely. And we are genuinely concerned about it, too. If you instituted a mask mandate, would that change what's going on in Orleans County or not? Would mask adherence become greater than it currently is there? Or is Orleans County, which is the third lowest vaccination rate in our state, be helped much more by uptake of vaccine, providing more access to that, providing more education about that? And you know, you can debate the answer to that question, but we really want to make an impact, and that's why we're actually heading there tomorrow with opportunities to answer more of the public's questions, engage them on the topic with the press briefing there, and mostly going to be an opportunity to answer questions and try to engage regarding vaccination and getting their rate up to protect the citizens in that region of the state.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Kirk in Montpelier. Kirk, you're on the line with Dr. Levine.
Thank you. Just continuing what you were just talking about a little, I would have thought that the very high rate of incidents we've had in the last month, combined with the fact that we have such a high rate of vaccination, could also have suggested that we've developed here in Vermont a rather contagious version of COVID-D.
So Delta is an incredibly contagious version. And that's why my comments about mask mandates and my observations of their impact was made, because I do think we're dealing with the same SARS-CoV virus, but a very different variant in terms of the number of people one person can infect. We also have to remember that cases are a meaningful indicator but there's a lot of behind the case information one needs to know. And some of that is what some of the more serious outcomes are, and are we seeing them in increasing numbers, and are they overwhelming the healthcare system? But others are who is actually getting sick, what is their illness like, how many of them are not eligible for vaccine and under age 12 and having a much milder illness or sometimes not even a symptomatic illness. So there's a lot of details to take into account as we think through this.
Dr. Levine, we have 2 minutes left in the show, but I want to get to one last caller. Let's go to Matt in South Burlington. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question is just around the state and CDC guidelines for traveling, and specifically about returning from travel, if there are still guidelines around quarantine times and what you should do if you travel out of state.
So the only guidelines which really come from CDC are for international travel. And when we're talking about what I think you're talking about, which is domestic travel, there really aren't major guidelines that you have to worry about. Obviously, some might submit that you could travel to a high-risk county in Vermont and perhaps be at higher risk today than you might be at another county in the United States, depending on where you chose to go. We still are of the opinion that it's a good idea to do testing ahead of your travels, so you know your status at that point, and then 3 to 5 days after you've returned from your travel, because travel in itself exposes you in many different ways than life at home might expose you. So we think the testing is a good idea, but if you're a vaccinated person, there's no need for quarantine related to travel in any direction.
Well, that's our show for today. Dr. Levine, as always, it's a pleasure, and I just thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.